So 2 Kings chapter 20, verses 12 to 21 is our text. And the standard approach to this passage goes like this. As these envoys from the king of Babylon visit Hezekiah, the whole thing goes to his head. He succumbs to a rush of pride and shamefully shows off all his treasures. That prompts Isaiah to subject Hezekiah to a frosty interrogation, at the end of which he announces the punishment which Hezekiah's pride has incurred, an announcement that in fact then leaves Hezekiah callously unperturbed, because the punishment affects future generations and so isn't his problem. That is more or less the standard approach. Some of you will recognize it from books that you have read and from sermons that you have heard. I have a feeling that when I preached a series on Hezekiah at NIREC about 15 years ago, that was my approach to this passage. It's not, however, my approach anymore. There are three main reasons for that. Reason number one, I'm now convinced that in order to moralize in Old Testament narratives, we have to be invited by the narrator to do so. So you think of the narrative about David and Bathsheba, and the contrast between how the actions of the two characters are portrayed. Are we invited to make a moral evaluation about David? Well, yes, certainly we are. For one thing, he's unambiguously described as doing something which the law of God unambiguously prohibits, sleeping with another man's wife. And then for another thing, it's expressly stated, the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. The narrator, in at least those two ways, is pushing us to conclude David is sinning. Are we invited to make a moral evaluation about Bathsheba? Well, no, we're not. We can present a version of the story, as many expositors have, in which Bathsheba is this siren, provocatively showing off her body in the hope of alluring another man while her husband is fighting at war. And it makes for a good sermon point about modesty and all that kind of stuff, but it owes nothing whatsoever to the text. He saw from the roof a woman bathing. That's all the narrator says. No invitation there to start to tut-tut about this woman's loose behavior. And when it comes to Hezekiah in our passage this evening, we're dealing then with a Bathsheba situation, not with a David situation. We can present a version of the story in which Hezekiah conducts this tour of his estate with his chest puffed out and smug self-congratulation oozing from his every pore. But we've left the text behind if we do that. The narrator doesn't show us some divine command being unambiguously broken here, as he does with David. He doesn't insert the sentence, the thing that Hezekiah had done displeased the Lord. He gives us no invitation to moralize. Reason number two. I'm now convinced that each component in the standard approach is problematic. So for one thing, the idea of Hezekiah showing off. Now, we don't say that about the Old Testament story that is most similar to this one. The Queen of Sheba in 1 Kings chapter 10, coming from afar to see all Solomon's treasures. There we say, wow, this is another indication of Solomon's greatness, attracting such international attention. Well, surely in the light of that, it's inconsistent to put a negative spin on this story now in 2 Kings 20. Why shouldn't it likewise be an indication of Hezekiah's greatness rather than his pride? Then there's the idea of the angry prophet Isaiah here. That too is problematic. For one thing, if it's such a frosty interrogation to which he subjects Hezekiah, Hezekiah doesn't seem to pick up that vibe. I mean, you'd have thought, wouldn't you, that by the third question, what have they seen in your house, Hezekiah might have sensed the prophet's disapproval and gone for a somewhat guarded answer. Oh, well, they saw one or two things, but nothing more than that. But he's as transparent as a piece of glass here, isn't he, in verse 15? They have seen all that's in my house. There is nothing in my storehouses that I did not show them. Either Hezekiah is unbelievably thick-skinned, or Isaiah is not asking these questions through gritted teeth and with glaring eyes. And for another thing, when Isaiah announces future disaster there in verses 16 to 18, he doesn't say that it's a consequence of Hezekiah's behavior here. He doesn't actually mention why the disaster is coming, which is unusual for a prophet who is in rebuking, condemning mode. Normally in such circumstances, they aren't shy about linking the punishment to the crime that has necessitated the punishment. If the crime here is Hezekiah's pride, you'd expect Isaiah to rub that in his face, but he doesn't. Perhaps we don't have here an angry prophet after all. And then there's the idea of Hezekiah's callous response to Isaiah's prophecy. As long as it's way down the line in the future, I don't care. The problem there is that that would mean that the very last detail in the whole Hezekiah story is an unsavory one, which seems to me unlikely. In ancient Jewish literature, beginnings and endings matter. Think of that very Jewish writer, John. And he writes his account of Jesus, what we call John's Gospel. And you can tell his assessment of Jesus just by consulting the beginning and the ending. It begins attributing deity to Jesus. The Word was with God and the Word was God. And it ends, at least the ending of the formal body of the book before the epilogue in chapter 21, it ends attributing deity again to Jesus, Thomas, my Lord and my God. And you would expect something similar then in this author's accounts of Hezekiah in 2 Kings 18 to 20. You'd expect to be able to tell, wouldn't you, his assessment of the man by consulting the beginning and the ending. Now, the beginning is stunningly positive. Stunningly positive there in the opening verses of chapter 18. You may remember them. And as I say, it seems unlikely then that the ending now is so different. And it portrays Hezekiah as this callous and selfish guy. I don't care about future generations. That would jar terribly, I think, in the Hebrew mind. Once again, the standard approach is problematic. So I've given you two reasons then why I reject the standard approach. It moralizes without an invitation to do so, and each of its components is problematic. But then reason number three, I'm now convinced that the passage yields a much more satisfactory interpretation when read messianically. Or to say the same thing in a different way, when read in conjunction with Isaiah chapter 53. Last Sunday evening I referred to Isaiah 53 quite a bit, and I'm going to do so again tonight. And as I say, I think that great messianic prophecy that we have there casts a whole new light on this passage that we're looking at here. No longer is it a passage about showing off treasures, angry prophetic condemnation, and callous disregard for the welfare of future generations. Read in conjunction with Isaiah 53, three other things are seen to be happening in these verses. First of all then, messianic supremacy recognized. That's my first heading. Messianic supremacy recognized. I want to suggest that when Isaiah hears of the king of Babylon visiting Hezekiah, he recognizes in that a miniature of what is going to happen with the Messiah. A miniature of the Messiah's global supremacy. We all, I'm sure, find Isaiah 53 deeply moving. What we can miss, however, are the grand global touches in that passage. So that line in chapter 52, verse 15, by the way, I'm using the phrase Isaiah 53 loosely tonight. I'm including in that the end of chapter 52. So Isaiah chapter 52, verse 15. So shall he sprinkle many nations. That's quite a line. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Now, sprinkling in the Old Testament is priestly activity. In texts like Leviticus 4:6 and 14:7, we have the priests sprinkling blood on things in order to cleanse and purify them. Isaiah, however, foresees the Messiah sprinkling the nations, acting as a priest toward the world. It's hugely impressive what he's talking about in that line. And then that other line in the same verse of his prophecy, again, chapter 52, verse 15, kings shall shut their mouths because of him, because of the Messiah, that is. Kings shall shut their mouths, specifically, the next line says, because of something that they see. What does Isaiah mean there? Alec Mateer, in his commentary, says that we are meant to hold the thought for a while, and it's later in chapter 53, verse 12, that we find out what these kings see that makes them shut their mouths. They see the Messiah's spoil. That's the word there in chapter 53, verse 12. What he has secured by his victory. He has secured the very creation, no less. He has won it back from the enemy for God. And these kings of the nations, whose field of expertise, of course, is spoil. That's what kings in the ancient world were into. They were into spoil. They've never seen spoil like the Messiah's spoil before. Nothing on that kind of scale. And they're gobsmacked as they see it. So as I say, there are these grand global touches in Isaiah 53. And here in our passage then is the very man who has been given these insights by the Spirit of God, the prophet Isaiah. And he discovers one day that the king of Babylon has visited Hezekiah. And two interesting things about this visit. Number one, the king of Babylon sends Hezekiah a present, verse 12 of our passage. A present, but that's actually a terribly bland translation. It's really an offering. The word occurs often, again, in the book of Leviticus. And what did an Israelite worshipper do with one of these offerings that he had? Well, of course, he presented it to the priest. Priests received offerings. And here then, Hezekiah receives an offering, but not from an Israelite worshipper, from a foreigner. He's acting as a priest toward the world here, is Hezekiah. And then number two, the king of Babylon, on visiting Hezekiah, sees. See is a key word in verses 13 to 15. It's used, I think, five times in the Hebrew, sometimes translated see, sometimes translated show. It's the same Hebrew word. And what the king of Babylon sees on this visit is almost certainly Hezekiah's spoil. How does Hezekiah have all this stuff that he shows the king of Babylon? Well, because, remember, we were told right at the beginning of chapter 18, chapter 18, verses 7 and 8, that the Lord was with Hezekiah wherever he went out, that's went out to battle, he prospered, he struck down the Philistines. He was a conqueror, he won battles. And this stuff then that the king of Babylon sees as he comes to visit him, it is Hezekiah's spoil. And so you get in where I'm going with this as Isaiah discovers then that for one thing, Hezekiah has been acting as a kind of priest to the world, this foreigner bringing an offering to him. And as Isaiah discovers for another thing that Hezekiah's spoil has been wowing a foreign king, Isaiah, bells are ringing in his head. He recognizes in all of this a miniature, a fleeting anticipation of the Messiah's global supremacy. So that in my view, his volley of questions to Hezekiah there in verses 14 and 15 isn't asked accusingly, it's asked excitedly. He's excited as he asks these questions. What did these men say? Where did they come from? What are they seeing in your house? This is 1 Peter 1, verses 10 and 11 in action. Do you remember Peter's words there? We've referred to them fairly recently, where Peter talks, doesn't he, about the Old Testament prophets and how they searched and inquired carefully, inquiring what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the subsequent glories. Here we have Isaiah doing that, searching and inquiring, desperately trying to process these messianic glimpses that he's seeing in this incident, thrilled by these small intimations of the Messiah's global supremacy. And my application then at this point this evening is simply, are we thrilled by the global supremacy of Jesus Christ? Think of what is happening in the world today. And I mean literally today, this Sunday. Think of what is happening. And all across the globe, people of different nations and tongues are bringing offerings to Jesus Christ, sacrifices of praise in the language of Hebrews 13:50. What was faintly anticipated in solitary Merodach Baladan bringing his measly offering to Hezekiah here, it has now exploded into reality with Jesus. Doesn't the global scale of the whole thing bring goosebumps to you? And things are going to get even more thrilling still. The day is going to come when all the kings of this age will be dumbstruck before King Jesus and the sheer extent of his spoil. Those rulers that were mentioned in that quote I read this morning, Alexander and Caesar and Napoleon, Vladimir Putin, if you want to bring things right up to date, the little territories that they managed to claim will then be seen to be so pitiful and so pathetic as Jesus rolls back the curtain and displays for all to see an entire cosmos. It's every galaxy, it's every particle, it's every blade of grass reclaimed from enemy control and all his to share joyously with his people. Is our Jesus sometimes a bit small? The Jesus that we present, the Jesus that we think about, the Jesus that we talk about, a bit too domesticated, a Jesus who's still kind of stuck in Bethlehem mode. Jesus is big, globally supreme. Get that into your thinking, Christian. Get that into your bloodstream. Isaiah is excited as he just sees the faintest glimpse in one little visit of a man to Hezekiah, the faintest little glimpse of Jesus' global supremacy. You and I know much more about it. We've seen it unfold before our eyes in 2022. Let's be more excited than even Isaiah was. And so that's the first thing that we have here, messianic supremacy recognized. But then secondly, messianic suffering recalled. Messianic suffering recalled. Now Isaiah's understanding of the Messiah is very incomplete. He is one of those searching and inquiring Old Testament prophets, groping for clarity in an age of restricted revelation. But Isaiah, from his Spirit-given insights, has, I think, grasped one thing, and it's this. There's no global supremacy for the Messiah without suffering. Suffering is the necessary route to supremacy. And I would put it to you, that's the explanation for the sudden shift in verses 16 to 18 to more somber material. It's not that he's crossly announcing judgment because Hezekiah has been a right show-off. It's rather that the thought of the Messiah's global supremacy has made Isaiah suddenly recall its necessary precursor, the thing that must come first, suffering. Now, you might be thinking, but come on, Dan, you're being a bit far-fetched now. Verses 16 to 18 are just about Judah's forthcoming exile in Babylon. They have nothing to do with the Messiah's suffering. Well, let's look more closely. Certainly, verse 17 is a fairly generic description of the Babylonian exile. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. But in verse 18, things get more unusual and less generic. It continues, and some of your own sons who shall be born to you shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Some of your own sons. Remember, Isaiah is talking here to Hezekiah, the Davidic king. This line of David is meant to last forever. That's what the promises all said. But eunuchs, eunuchs aren't going to do much for this line's prospects of lasting forever. But then your mind goes to Isaiah 53 again. And you begin to suspect that Isaiah is really thinking here of one member of David's line who in a particular way will become like a eunuch. Because this is what we read in Isaiah 53 and verse 8. There we read these words, by oppression and judgment he, this is the Messiah of course, by oppression and judgment he was taken away. Now taken away is the exact same Hebrew word that we have in verse 18 of our passage. Some of your own sons shall be taken away. And then Isaiah 53 verse 8 continues, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? I think the NIV captures better what is being said here. And who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. Who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. In other words, this verse is saying the Messiah is going to become like a eunuch, cut off in his prime with no descendants. That's the point being made. No descendants. And I think that's what Isaiah means here then in our passage, verse 18. He is prophesying about the Messiah here, not just about the Babylonian exile. And okay, it's a bit blurry, because of course the Messiah isn't going to be a eunuch in the palace of the king of Babylon. As I said, Isaiah's understanding is somewhat incomplete. Having said that, actually, it's worth noting it is a prominent theme in the early chapters of Matthew's Gospel. Some of you may dimly remember from when we did a series in Matthew's Gospel, it is a prominent theme there that God's people are still in exile as Jesus the Messiah steps onto the scene. That fascinating genealogy in Matthew chapter 1, which specifically flags up the moment that Judah goes into the exile, but never flags up Judah coming out of the exile. As if to say God's people are still in exile as Jesus now steps onto the scene. So perhaps it's not that ridiculous what Isaiah is saying here in verse 18 about Babylon and linking the Messiah with Babylon. But I hope you get this point then that I'm making. Isaiah has glimpsed in the visit of the king of Babylon the Messiah's global supremacy. But that then makes him recall the Messiah's suffering, which must inevitably come first. And I want to just pause at this point then and say this. I have a feeling we haven't reflected enough on that little detail of the Messiah's suffering explicit in Isaiah 53 verse 8 and more opaquely intimated here in 2 Kings 20 verse 18, namely his childlessness. His childlessness. In Jewish culture, that was such a big deal, wasn't it? Remember that law in Deuteronomy 25, that if a married man dies childless, his brother is to marry his widow in order, as it says there, to perpetuate his brother's name. That is to have children who could be counted as the dead man's children. Fathering children was that important in Jewish culture. And it adds then to the shameful sense of failure surrounding this man hanging on Golgotha's middle cross. It's bad enough that his life at 33 has come to this kind of ending at all. What a wreck you must have made of your life to come to this, to have to end it in this way. But there isn't even the silver lining that at least he leaves descendants. No, he dies childless. No descendants. In a Jewish culture that values children and progeny and perpetuating the line and the name so highly, Jesus dies without descendants. He dies like a eunuch. He dies childless. He would have felt that himself. He would have felt that as one little aspect at least of the shame crushing in on him that Friday afternoon. There's his mother at the foot of the cross whom we considered this morning. And she doesn't even have grandchildren to provide at least some consolation for the fact that her boy is suffering like this, just meters away from her. And I think it's only when we've grappled then with what verse 8 of Isaiah 53 is saying, that that's what it's talking about. The shameful failure, or apparent failure, the shameful sense of failure that he himself would have had, dying without descendants. It's only when we've grappled with that, that we're ready for what comes just afterwards in Isaiah 53. In verse 10, he shall see his offspring. He shall see his offspring. And then referring to the same thing, surely, in the next verse, he shall see, verse 11, and be satisfied. He shall see his offspring, and that will give him satisfaction. I said the other Sunday morning that the Father's reward for his son's suffering, I think, corresponds to the suffering, we might say, almost point for point. He wears a crown of thorns. Now he's crowned with glory and honor. He wears a garish purple robe. Now he's arrayed in resurrection splendor. They cry, crucify him. Now they cry, praise him. In heaven, the angels and all the saints who are already there. And similarly then, it's as if the Father said, as he seated his son at his right hand upon his ascension back into heaven, it's as if the Father said, son, you bore the shame of dying on that cross without offspring, a eunuch, childless, in a culture that so values having descendants. Now, son, I am going to fill this world with offspring for you, with a family that's your very own. And we are that family. We are those offspring this evening. That's who the offspring are in Isaiah 53, 10 and 11. Christians, believers. We are what he sees tonight and is satisfied at seeing. The one who died childless now looks out on offspring in Asia and in Europe and in America and in Africa and across this globe. And tonight then he attracts the attention of an angel standing near and he says, look at those people in NREC, see them? They're my offspring. I've got offspring now. I've got children. I've got people in this world who are my family. Those people there, they are mine. They're my children. And he revels in that. And he delights in that. And he's satisfied in the fact that we're his offspring. Is that not a wonderful thing? Does that not give dignity to your life this evening as a Christian? You may feel that there's little dignity about your life because you're suffering and people think you're a fool for being a Christian. Does that not give a great dignity to your life as a Christian tonight that the Son of God looks at you from heaven and is satisfied because you're his offspring? So, we've seen then messianic supremacy recognized. Messianic suffering we call, but let's notice finally one third thing. Messianic substitution relished. Messianic substitution relished. Do you expect to see Hezekiah in the world to come? I expect we would all say yes. We anticipate seeing Hezekiah in the world to come. Well, if so, then Hezekiah must have been a believer in Jesus. There'll be no one in the world to come who's there by any other route than being a believer in Jesus Christ. Actually, Hezekiah is a particularly privileged believer, or a particularly privileged Old Testament believer in Jesus, is he not? Because he's a contemporary of the prophet Isaiah, who was probably given the greatest insights into the coming Messiah of any Old Testament prophet. Not only would Hezekiah then have had access to Isaiah's prophetic oracles about the Messiah, but doubtless he talked with him often about these things as well. I mean, you get the impression, don't you, throughout the Hezekiah story that there's a close relationship between the two men. Doubtless they are kindred spirits. In Judah, where probably there's not a great deal of anticipation about the future Messiah, and these men, they doubtless had late night conversations over a cup of coffee about the coming Messiah. So that when Isaiah here, in verse 18, connects eunuchs with the line of David, Hezekiah probably picked up on that train of thought that I've just developed and unfolded for you. His mind too probably went to Isaiah 53:8 because he'd heard Isaiah talk about exactly those kinds of things. He appreciated that there was some messianic germ at least in the language of that prophecy in verse 18 of our passage. And that's why then he responds in verse 19, the word of the Lord that you have spoken is good. Truly it is good. It's about the Messiah. Of course it's good. You see, normally to be glad that others are going to suffer instead of you, which Hezekiah goes on to refer to in the second half of verse 19. Normally, to be glad that others are going to suffer instead of you is selfish and callous, isn't it? One of the songs that will be playing in lots of shops at this time of year is that song, Do They Know It's Christmas? 1984 Band-Aid song written and performed to raise money for famine victims in Ethiopia. And its most controversial line then, referring to the famine afflicted Ethiopians, is this: well, tonight, thank God, it's them instead of you. I think the line has been greatly misunderstood, given it was written by Bob Geldof, and I think there's an awful lot of sarcasm in the line that is being missed by people who criticize it. But you can see why it raises eyebrows, because, as I say, normally to be glad that others are going to suffer rather than you is selfish and callous. But there's one situation where that doesn't apply. Jesus, the Messiah, came precisely in order to suffer for us, in our place, as our substitutes. And that is meant to be received with joy and with gladness and with gratitude. I mean, you sense it in Isaiah 53 itself, especially verse 5. I mean, verse 5 is such a wonderful verse, isn't it? If, as I said earlier, Isaiah 53 is a mountaintop within the whole Bible, verse 5 is a mountaintop on the mountaintop. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And that's interesting. Peace. Shalom. The very word that Hezekiah uses here in verse 19. There will be peace, shalom, and security in my days. I don't think this is a man selfishly thinking, as long as the Babylonian exile is going to be after my time, I don't really care because it won't affect me. I think this is a man whose ears have just discerned a prophecy about the Messiah's suffering, and who is relishing the fact that all his days, whatever external circumstances they may feature, all his days will be characterized by the deepest shalom because of the Messiah's substitutionary sacrifice. And you and I then can relish that too tonight, if we're believers in Jesus Christ. We have peace. We have shalom. All our days, as Hezekiah says here, regardless of external circumstances, our external circumstances may be very rocky, very up and down, very difficult, but we have peace because the chastisement that brought us peace was on Jesus. Messiah has suffered. Messiah has borne the wrath of Almighty God. He took the chastisement, the punishment, the righteous indignation of the Most High. We get the peace. Our lives flooded at the deepest level with peace. Not necessarily circumstantial, but true peace. Peace with our God. Reconciliation with the one who will allocate our eternal destiny to us. That's worth relishing. That's what Hezekiah was relishing, I think. This is not a self-absorbed individual who only cares that he can get to his deathbed without anything too disastrous happening between now and then. This is a man who sees dimly but really the Messiah suffering and recognizes that if the Messiah is going to suffer for him, he has peace. He has peace with God. And you and I know that much more fully and clearly through our completed revelation this evening. The Messiah suffered for us. We therefore have peace with God. Peace and security all our days. Bequeathed to us by our crucified Redeemer. Revel in that. Relish it. Whatever this week may hold, and we don't know what it will hold, and there may be nasty things that it will hold, we have peace nonetheless. Some of you may be in your senior years and every day may be a toil, just getting out of bed, just living. Still, you have peace with God. Relish that. Thank God with all your heart tonight for that peace that has come to you through the chastisement of his own Son. Amen.